for Nature.com and Nature Publishing Group, which means I'm responsible for our online activities and businesses. So I'm a publisher of sorts, but I'm also a neurophysiologist. I'm a web geek. I'm an Englishman with a Polish mother, a Scottish father, a Japanese wife, and a Finnish first name. My life story to date has been sort of a long series of sort of cultural misunderstandings and conflicts of various kinds. And that has coloured the view that I'm about to give you, which is a very personal view. I can't say that even everyone at Nature Publishing Group or even anyone at Nature Publishing Group would necessarily share all of it, still less that all publishers would share it. But this is, in fact, I'm going to be talking about some of this stuff to a bunch of publishers in London on Friday. So if I disappear from without trace shortly after that, you'll know that they don't agree with what I'm about to say. This is a very personal view as to what I think the stance of publishers should be with respect to the various changes that are happening and the opportunities and threats that arise. The title of my talk is inspired by two very well-known quotes, which I'm sure you're familiar with. The past is a foreign country, they do things differently there. That's from the novel The Go-Between by L.P. Hartley. And another one, The Future is Here, It's Just Not Evenly Distributed Yet, by William Gibson. And, you know, perhaps appropriately enough, they're famous quotes, but they're famous in different circles, right? The one at the top that perhaps appropriate enough talks about the past is much better known in literary circles, and the one at the bottom, which focuses on the future, is best known among technologists. But I think they sort of speak to they express a sort of fundamental truth or a series of fundamental truths, which is that, you know, the past and the future do influence what we're doing here. I mean, and in some sense, you know, some people are already living in the future, some people are further ahead and other people are further behind. And as the pace of change accelerates, I think that sense is also accentuated. And I also think that our attitude to change and our attitude to foreign ideas, whether they're foreign ideas of the kind that are going to shape the future or foreign ideas that come from literally from other lands, I think are sort of correlated. So I wanted to start off by sort of slightly self-indulgently giving you a little bit of story about something that had an experience I had that had a really sort of fundamental effect on the way I think about things and the way I approach respond to change and as it were foreign ideas. So when I was about 20 years ago, when I was a student, I went to Japan. I was supposed to only be there for 6 months or so. I was traveling around the world, and I more or less ended up there by accident. And so just as today, I'm kind of a digital migrant, if you like. I don't feel like I'm someone who's been brought up and born in the digital world. I didn't use email when I was at university. I didn't use the web. These are all things I've adopted since I've finished my full-time education. At that time, I was also, you know, literally a migrant, a geographical migrant. And that really sort of colored my perception as to how we approach new ideas and what our attitudes ought to be, and therefore my opinion about how I think publishers ought to respond to the changes that are happening at the moment. So I'd traveled a lot up to that point because my father was an airline pilot, but I traveled a lot in the West. I hadn't traveled in the East almost at all. I traveled a bit in Africa. And nothing really prepared me for what I found in Japan, okay? It was just the weirdest place. And, you know, it's this immense concrete jungle. You know, some aspects of Blade Runner sort of came to mind when I was there. There were weird kind of combinations of new and old, of the familiar and the unfamiliar. There was of Occident and Orient as well. Okay, so you get these really kind of interesting combinations and juxtapositions of things. You know, so here we see a McDonald's, but it's got funny lettering all over it. And, you know, on one corner we've got this, you know, slightly foreign looking but really very Western fast food outlet. On this corner we've got a condom shop, right? I mean, you know, this is Shibuya in Tokyo. It was just the combination of things was really very strange to me. Lots of unconventional people as well. This is Harajuku, an area in Tokyo where young people hang out, and particularly on a Sunday, and will dress up in all kinds of amazing clothing. This was very unfamiliar to me, even though I was probably the same age as them at the time. there are also lots of strange contradictions, it seemed to me, just, you know, silly anecdotal ones, right? So in Japan, there's lots and lots of automatic doors, right? So even the taxi doors open automatically, right? You don't touch them, otherwise the driver gets very upset. They open and close automatically, right? But when you go to a restaurant, you're expected to cook the food yourself, right? It just seemed to me that this was a really odd kind of situation, right? So I felt very much out of, you know, I was a fish out of water, I suppose you could say. And, you know, another one, the Japanese work amazingly long hours. They work amazingly hard, and they're all sleep deprived. So when you go on the train, you know, this is the kind of scene you see. I mean, the web is replete with photographs of Japanese people on trains sleeping in sort of strange positions. You know, this is a fairly typical, you know, view of the last train home at night at 1 o'clock in the morning or something. They work amazingly, amazingly hard. Yet you go to the ATM, closes at 6 p.m. sharp, right? And so there were these kind of odd combinations of things that just seemed outlandish to me. And actually, I mean, going back to the sort of the overwork thing. I mean, you know, Japanese has a term called karoshi for death through overwork, right? So, you know, a tip for would-be migrants is, you know, think twice before you go to a country that has reduced, you know, where the concept of death through overwork is so commonplace that they've reduced it to a three-syllable word, you know, like the word holiday in English, for example, right? So, you know, but yet the machines, you know, they obviously have to rest in the evening. And above all for me, just the amazing weirdness of the writing system, right, which is derived from Chinese. It's not the same as Chinese, but it's derived from Chinese. And in fact, early Western visitors to China were convinced that the Chinese language was not a real language that the Chinese used to communicate, but one that they used only in the presence of Westerners in order to confound them and confuse them. And I know exactly how they felt, right? I mean, you know, when I came across this stuff. So my response to all of this kind of insane weirdness was, this is fantastic, this is brilliant, this is wonderful, it's inspiring, it's full of possibilities, and I want to learn more about it. So instead of staying there 6 months, I ended up staying there 5 years. I married a Japanese lady, we go back there every year, our kids are bilingual, you know, so it really sort of became ingrained in you know, what I am and how I think. And I think, you know, so enough about Japan. We're going to be talking about the internet and its impact on publishing. But I think, you know, similarly, the internet is a foreign land to publishers. And as I said earlier, we do talk about digital natives and digital migrants. And, you know, there are certain parallels. There are strange languages when it comes to computer science. Now, this is a famous piece of C code that will print out the 12 verses of the 12 days of Christmas, and it's deliberately obfuscated. But it's illustrating the point, which is that you do get these very, very strange languages. These are completely foreign to publishers. Publishers haven't had to deal with this kind of stuff before. And although this is deliberately obfuscated in the way that early Western visitors to China thought that Chinese was deliberately designed to confound them, you know, we've all had the conversation with the guy from IT who's using language that we think is being deliberately obscure. And I think when publishers are, you know, come across information technology, that's often the feeling as well. You also get, I mean, that's a language designed to be used and interpreted by computers, but even human languages, this is probably my favorite example of English rendered as text messaging. This is quite a famous example, so some of you might be familiar with it. This is actually an essay submitted by a 13-year-old girl to her teacher at school in the UK. She was asked to write about her summer holiday. So we can, if you're interested, we can read along together, okay? So I think it's quite amusing, right? So she submitted this to her teacher. Of course, her teacher didn't know how to interpret this, but it was perfectly obvious to this young girl and her friends, actually. So my summer holidays were a complete waste of time. Before, we used to go to New York to see my brother and his girlfriend and three screaming kids face to face. I love New York, it's great. But my parents were so worried because of 9/11 that they decided to stay in Scotland and spend 2 weeks up north. This is one of my favorite lines. Up north, what you see is what you get, nothing. I was very bored in the middle of nowhere. This is another of my favorite lines. Nothing but sheep and mountain. I can't remember what this, I've forgotten this one now. At any rate, my parents were happy. They said it could be worse and that they were happy for the peace and quiet. I don't think so. I wanted to go home as soon as possible to see my mates again. Today, I came back to school. I feel very saintly because I've done all my homework. Now it's business as usual. Okay, so actually it does make sense, but not to her teacher, sadly for her. So she probably didn't feel very saintly for very long. And I think, you know, as well as these sort of new languages, there are new currencies, methods of payment. There are also, I think, even more importantly, new cultural currencies, right? There's the sort of, as it were, the GIF culture of open source software that people like Eric Raymond have written about, the link culture of the web, which actually for academic publishers specifically shouldn't be particularly alien because they come out of very much the sort of academic mindset. The currency of reputation that exists in open source software is very similar to the one that exists in academia and arguably is derived from it. And the link culture on the web is very similar to the citation culture in science and other parts of academia. You also get these strange combinations like the ones I described in Japan, right? You know, whoever would have thought that this thing would get together with this thing to produce this thing, right? You know, this is very strange for us. Even relatively new things are morphing, you know, so we're increasingly getting computers without keyboards, games, game devices, and others. we also get new, as I said, new cultural norms. Cory Doctorow, who's a writer, digital activist, one of the editors of Boing Boing, a blog that was mentioned earlier on yesterday. You know, he makes a really good point, which is that, you know, if email had been designed by lawyers instead of by engineers, there's no way that it would have by default copied the text of your correspondence in that when you hit the reply button, still less the forward button, right? I mean, this is something that sort of ingrains into a piece of software and therefore into the people that use it, kind of mass copyright infringement, okay? But it's incredibly useful, and so people use it, and actually they don't think terribly much about it. I think it's also an indication, incidentally, that copyright is really profoundly broken in the digital age, but I won't go off on that particular rant because that's another talk altogether. There is this sort of divide between people who are familiar with this stuff, who are generally younger people, but not exclusively, and people to whom this is very alien. And to most publishers, actually, it is very alien. This is one of my favorite photos. This is a photo from Joy Ito, who's a web entrepreneur in Japan, and so it was taken on a train in Japan. But I think it could have been anywhere, actually, although in Japan, some of the things indicated here are more advanced than they are elsewhere. The thing about this is, wherever you're from, half of the picture will look familiar and half of it will look foreign to you, okay? Right, so, you know, this guy is reading a book and this guy is reading his phone, right? And from the point of view of publishers, in some ways, the important thing to think about from a business perspective is that the net present value of the cash flows from this guy are much more than from this guy, because he's old, right? And he's young. But the other thing that I think publishers feel at looking something like that is just what I said earlier, this guy's reading his phone. I mean, just think about how bizarre that is. He's reading his phone, right? I mean, you know, you might as well tell a record company that people are listening to their ironing boards or something. I mean, this is really, 20 years ago, it just wouldn't happen, right? How can you imagine that somebody would be reading their phone, okay? And this is, I think, indicative of, first of all, it feels very surreal, right? So, you know, you feel like you're in this Alice in Wonderland place that where nothing makes sense anymore. But also it's indicative of you know, convergence, right? So now people don't just read on their phones, they communicate in other ways, they play games. So this is also a manifestation of a very important trend, which is that publishers are no longer competing with other publishers. They're really very fundamentally, they're competing with entertainment companies, movie companies, games companies. They're no longer just dealing with wholesalers and retailers, they're dealing with mobile phone operators, right? And ISPs and all of these kinds of people, right? So it's a profoundly different new world, right? And that freaks people out. Again, you know, relating it again to my experience going to Japan, personally, I think this is brilliant, right? I think, again, it's wonderful, it's inspiring, it's full of possibility, and I want to learn about it. Publishing since Gutenberg 550 years ago, whatever it is, has been a pretty boring place. I don't think I'd be in it if it wasn't going through a revolution at the moment. But that doesn't go for everyone by a long shot. So publishers, you know, how do and how should publishers respond to those changes? Well, the sort of the, as it were, the one side of the publisher reaction, and perhaps the one that's, unfortunately, from my point of view, best known, is this sort of thing. If I can get the next slide, okay, Prism. Okay, so Prism. For, I mean, I can already hear that some of you know what I'm talking about. Prism is what's commonly known as an AstroTurf sort of project that was designed to. So it's a fake grassroots campaign instigated by some publishers to basically deliver the message that open access, in particular, is a threat to the integrity of the scientific literature, and that there are not just publishers but scientists who sort of support this point of view. I think you know, the most polite word I can use about it is misguided. Right? I mean, it's just fundamentally wrong, and it backfired spectacularly. And I think that was predictable, and I think it was a really bad idea. But I think it's also, it was really bad because it reflected badly on publishers as a whole. And, you know, as I said at the beginning, I can't speak for all publishers, but I think one of the reasons for that is there's a huge diversity among publishers, as individuals and as organizations. And I think we sometimes lose sight of that. Certainly when I see comments of people talking about the publishing industry as a sort of, as if it were a monolithic entity, I sort of feel very strongly that it's not, right? I mean, that, for example, it's very common to bundle nature, science, and cell together. And if you've got a really hot molecular biology paper and you're wondering where to send your paper, you can bundle them together because those are three options for you, okay? If you're talking about the publishing industry, I can't think of three more different organizations, right? Nature Publishing Group, medium-sized commercial player, I think relatively progressive. You know, you be the judge by the end of my talk. Science, a pretty small in the scheme of things, society, not-for-profit publisher with one title. Cell, part of Elsevier, you know, behemoth of the industry, you know, in some senses the Microsoft of the industry, hugely successful, very big, very powerful, doing some good stuff, incidentally, but also, you know, with a reputation for being somewhat reactionary and partly because of their commercial success being unduly sort of influenced by money rather than actually trying to do good things for people and the constituencies they serve. So those are three incredibly different organizations with very different activities, very different stances with respect to what's going on at the moment. And I think it's not helpful to sort of lump them together, which often happens, I think too often happens. What I actually see in the publishing industry is a wide diversity of opinion. You get a small number of people, a small proportion of people, who really embrace change, perhaps even, you get a large group in the middle who are largely ignorant of what's going on or don't care very much, and then you get a bunch of people who are very resistant to it. And I actually don't think, I think first of all that situation is improving. I think people in the industry are getting more clueful. I think they're embracing change more, not enough in my opinion, but they are doing it more and more, so the situation is improving. And I think it's not that different to actually what goes on elsewhere, right? I mean, there's a quote here from Jim Hendler. Jim Hendler is one of the sort of key practitioners and designers of the semantic web. So he's a computer scientist, but he's very interested in the way that the information technology is used in the natural sciences. And he wrote in an essay a few months ago, while scientists are glorified in the disruptive effect that the web is having on publishers and libraries, with many feel strongly pushing open publication models, we are much more resistant to letting it be a disruptive force in the practice of our disciplines. And I think certainly in some of the conversations I've been having at this meeting, I think it's clear to me anyway, that is the case. I mean, that scientists as a whole, and I think it would exclude the people in this room, because obviously we're a self-selected bunch who are interested in this stuff, but scientists as a whole really don't want to change their behaviors. They don't want to change the way they do science. I think in that regard, scientists are not that much different from publishers. It's not that scientists are intrinsically progressive and publishers are intrinsically resistant. It's that in both areas there are intrinsically progressive people and intrinsically resistant people. And I think until we recognise that, it's going to be, you know, difficult to move things forward. That said, you know, I think it did take publishers to come up with Prism, so I wouldn't I wouldn't defend that. And I think we as an industry have to be a bit more careful about how we do things. I mean, actually, just to give one specific example as well about scientists. When NIH, I forget the exact timing, a year or so ago, I suppose it was, a year or two ago, requested, so this is before the requirement, requested that their fund holders deposit their manuscripts in the PubMed Central Archive, they got 4% compliance, which I just think is just astonishingly low, right? I mean, this is, so it wasn't a requirement, it was a request, but you know, hey, if my boss or my shareholder or something kind of like politely requested that I did something, you know, there's more than a 4% chance that I would have done it, I think. So one of the things we did at Nature was we offered our authors the facility whereby we would actually deposit on their behalf, but we needed their permission in order to do that. We weren't allowed to just do it automatically. And so we asked them, we said, would you like us to put your, this is for NIH-funded authors, obviously, would you like us to put your manuscript into PubMed Central for you and then you don't have to do anything? And we got 30% compliance. So 30% is a lot higher than 4%, but it still means that, you know, 70% of scientists can't even be bothered to say yes to support the open dissemination of their work, which is depressing, I think. Since then, NIH has required that they do it, and the compliance rate has gone up, but it's well short of 100%. It's probably more like this 30% level. I haven't been following it very closely. I know some funders in other countries who've been experimenting with some other things and had a similar results so far. Now, no doubt those compliance rates will climb, but it's not as if there's a, you know, a huge kind of, you know, lurking demand for scientists to be able to put this stuff in repositories like PubMed Central. Most of them are indifferent at best about it, and I think we need to work hard to overcome that. So I want to talk a bit about what I, you know, what being progressive involves, the kind of mindset, and also the things that we've been doing that I think are indicative of, you know, what we're trying to do, and I'd be interested in any feedback about whether what we're doing is right. First of all, I think it's really important to be clear about what your mission is and to interpret your mission broadly. So let me tell you what I mean by that by showing you the Nature mission statement. It actually comes in two parts. This was published in the second issue of Nature in 1869, so the language is not fully up to date, but I think the principles and the sense of it is completely relevant still. So first, to place before the general public the grand results of scientific work, scientific discovery, and to urge the claims of science for more general recognition in education and daily life. That's actually the first mission. It's not even so actually disseminating the fruits of science to the public at large, which has already been a topic of discussion at this meeting, it is the first part of Nature's mission statement, and one that we take very seriously. The second part, to aid scientific men, sorry, ladies, this was 1869, themselves giving early information of advances made in blah, 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 you know, that you can read the rest of that horrible Victorian prose yourselves. This is about enabling scientists to communicate with each other. So disseminate the results of science to society at large and help scientists communicate with each other. It doesn't say, you know, we are a journal publisher. It says this is our mission. Right? Our mission, we're a scientific communication company, right? We enable the flow of scientific information. That's why we exist. If we don't do it, then we shouldn't be around. And if we do do it and we do a good job, maybe we still deserve to exist. It doesn't say anything about being a journal publisher. Although being a journal publisher or publishing journals has been our main business in 140 years since Nature was first published. Okay, so this is really helpful to people like me because I get to say that all of this wacky stuff we're doing online is actually fulfilling these missions, right? It doesn't say that we're supposed to be a journal publisher. It's also really good for us as a company because, you know, God knows where journal publishing is going, okay? And whether it's going to be an interesting activity or business in years to come. I think it's still going to be with us for the foreseeable future, but we shouldn't be kind of like stuck in that particular pigeonhole, right? There are many other opportunities, particularly with the web. The web is, you know, the most powerful information communication medium we've ever had, and we should be exploiting it to the full. If we're a scientific communication company, there are many, many opportunities for us to add value and to make create new businesses off the back of that. I'll talk a little bit about some of our projects. Maybe some of them will be familiar to you, so I won't dwell on them for a very long time, but I'll just take you through some of the things we're doing. And this is roughly in chronological order that we launched them, so other than that, it's a fairly arbitrary order. Konnatea is what's known as a social bookmarking service. It's basically a clone of Delicious for people who know Delicious, with some extra functionality for academics. For example, it will pick up, if you bookmark a journal paper, it will pick up the name of the journal and the authors and so forth automatically for you. You can type in what's known as a DOI, a digital object identifier, which is a unique identifier that most academic papers have. So you can even bookmark something that you're reading in print. You just go into the website, you type in the DOI, which will usually be somewhere on the bottom or top of the page, and it will go and pick up all the metadata from a database run by an organization called Crossref. So you can actually bookmark things that you're reading in print as well, and again, it will pull in all the metadata, the journal name, the publication date, the author, and so forth. So it grew out of, or was inspired by Delicious, which is this social bookmarking tool, and therefore enables you to share links with other people, as well as keeping your own collections and keeping them private if you want to. But it's also something of a kind of citation management tool as well, in a fairly crude kind of web-enabled kind of way. The Nature podcast, we started doing a weekly podcast for Nature in October 2005, I think it was. It feels like a long time ago now. And it was an experiment. We decided that we wanted to do some podcasts, and the initial thought was we should go away and do some market research to find out if there was a demand for such a thing. And then about 2 minutes into that conversation, it became apparent that doing the podcast was cheaper than doing the market research, so we should just do a podcast, and then we'll know, right? So we did a podcast. We launched a weekly podcast for Nature. It features mainly author interviews. They're usually 4 minutes. We'll do a slightly longer interview, cut it down a bit. 4 minutes, author talking about their work with one of our journalists. Sometimes we do other sort of pieces as well, more journalistic pieces, conference reports, that kind of thing. We also now have a whole series of other subject area podcasts. So this is a weekly one for Nature, but we do regular ones in chemistry, I lose track now, which other ones we do, a whole bunch of them. Go to nature.com/podcast and you'll get a list. And we do one-off specials as well. We do like roundtable discussions and things on important topics. And this has been very successful. We did we started off as a 3-month trial back in late 2005. By the end of that trial, we had many tens of thousands of downloads each week. We were up in the iTunes chart. We were kind of, for a time, we were above Madonna's podcast. We were really pleased about that. We got a sponsor, so it was covering its costs. We sort of expanded it from there, as it were. But it's, you know, that aside from the sort of the success in terms of download and the success in terms of being able to actually generate some revenue from it, I think it's successful in terms of what it achieves as well. From the point of view of the listener, it can be consumed. Podcasts can be consumed when you're doing other things, right? So when you're doing an experiment, or when you're commuting, and what have you, at times when you couldn't possibly be browsing a website or a journal. So it enables people to make more efficient use of their time. And in fact, one of the most common requests we get is, you know, I have really long experiments. Can you make a longer show, please? Right? Which is, it's fine, but it takes a long time to put the shows together. But it's really, you know, great to have that kind of feedback. It also is a very, you know, listening to an author talking about their work is a very different experience to reading a paper. And I think there are some analogies here with blogs and some of the discussions that happened yesterday. These are scientists. This allows you to connect with scientists in a much more human way, right? You get to hear about their work and hear their enthusiasm for it, and sometimes hear some interesting anecdotes about why they did it or how they did it. It's much more accessible than the paper itself, and therefore also the podcast gets a very wide audience. It's probably something like about a third. We're never quite sure because it's hard to tell, but from surveys we've done, it's probably about a third of podcast listeners are just not scientists at all. They're just interested in science. So it's actually helping us fulfill the first part of our mission, right, which is the public outreach side, even though we created it with the explicit goal of serving Nature readers, in other words, professional scientists by and large. But that's because the nature of the audio medium, you know, a physicist and a biologist has to be able to listen all the way through. You can't dip in and out as easily as you can with written material. You have to be able to listen all the way through and not get lost, okay? So we have to pitch it at a level that non-experts can understand. I think the authors who get involved and appear on the show also find it useful because it gives them a platform and they can get heard by tens of thousands of their peers in other disciplines, and it helps, you know, it's a platform for them to talk about their work, and scientists do generally love talking about work. We're now doing more and more video as well. Nature puts out regular videos, journalistic coverage of its papers, that side of things is going to get more active as well in the coming months. Actually, before I say that, I should also just say, sorry, that before we did the podcast, so whatever, 2.5 years ago, Nature had never output audio or video content for that matter, right? Certainly not on a regular basis. So I think it's easy to kind of, especially in hindsight now that we've done that stuff, it's easy to underestimate the degree of change that's involved for us. We, you know, in a way have become a broadcaster, not just a publisher. And now for audio, not yet for video really, but for audio, it's just a natural ingrained part of what we do. Our journalists and editors are trained on this stuff. They can record, they can edit. We have a team that puts the shows together. We have a little studio that we built in London. We have a network of freelance people that help us put these shows together when we need them. It's just become a natural part of what we do. But 2.5 years ago, it was completely alien to us. This is a segment from a site called Postgenomic, which was created by a guy in my team called Ewan Addy, he actually created it before he joined the company, but it's been one of his projects that he's continued to work on since he joined us. Postgenomic, despite its name, actually covers all subjects in science, and it's a blog aggregator. It's a blog sort of post aggregator, so you can go in there and see blog posts have been issued about on different subject areas. It also does a kind of zeitgeisty type kind of analysis of stats analysis. So it does a pretty good job of picking up blog posts about papers. So it will tell you what are the most discussed papers in the scientific blogosphere. It will tell you which are the most discussed blogs, journals, you know, that kind of stuff. So it does some sort of statistical analysis and has some, you know, top 20 tables, which people seem to really love. So really interesting, useful site put together by you. And as I say, originally created by him before he joined us, but since then further developed while he's been at MPG. Nature Network is our kind of, if you like, Facebook for scientists. I don't really like that description, but that's a reasonable kind of one sentence description of it. So it includes blogs, and you can create personal networks and groups that can be private or public, open or closed, to discuss various things. We're trying to, again, this is a way of facilitating, you know, fast, immediate, spontaneous discussion and communication between scientists. And if they want, scientists speaking to the wider world. And in fact, our bloggers mainly do blog in such a way that is really speaking to the wider world or people outside their field. So that's Nature Network. Second Nature, in some ways, is sort of the most bizarre thing we got involved in and freaks people out the most. This is our was an island. It's now a little archipelago in Second Life, right? So we've got three islands at the moment. And we run scientific meetings there. We have a speaker series. And we also rent out our meeting space to other people who want to hold meetings and don't have their meeting space, their own meeting space. We also give land to various scientists who have projects going on in Second Life. Again, they're not doing stuff at a level that would make sense for them to kind of, you know, rent their own island. But we give them a little patch of land and encourage them to develop, you know, displays or a lot of it's educational stuff, illustrating scientific topics. There's some great chemistry stuff that John Claude Bradley did, actually, some of which he's, I think, moved on to his own stuff at Drexel, but some of which still is on our island. There's some great genetic stuff. And those are kind of intended to be, as I say, mainly educational tools. But we also have, you know, we have a big like PowerPoint display screen as well for doing the meetings. And we have an area where you can hold poster sessions as well in world. And what we're really trying to do there is to experiment with, you know, is there something that you can do that's between a big meeting like this where everyone has to fly, you know, all around the world to come together to meet? And if you do something like this, it has to go on for a couple of days at least because of the overhead of traveling and everyone getting together. Something between that and then, you know, maybe like a webinar or a conference call where everyone can get together for a short space of time, but you don't get any of the kind of presence cues, right? You don't get the idea of, you know, listening to a talk but having a quick chat with someone in the back row next to you, or being able to see who else is there and how they're responding, you know, being able to, all the kinds of dynamics that happen in the real world that just don't happen in forums like conference calls and webinars. And I think we found a sort of a model that works, the meeting. So it took some experimentation. The very first meeting we held in Second Life was actually a team meeting. So a team meeting of the team that I run were publishing, and it was a debacle. It was really it was the least productive meeting we've probably ever had. But it was hilarious. But it was just trying to get everyone lined up and sitting in the right place, and people had lost control of their avatars and stuff. But I think one of them came along with a cow. I don't know where he picked it up. Another had green hair. It was just like, you let loose the web geeks and this stuff and they just go wild. But we've gone through a learning experience since then. And I think, we now know how to put on these shows. Or I should say Jo Scott, who's the lady in my team who runs this stuff now, knows how to put on these shows. And we did a short series of talks to coincide with the Bali conference on climate change. Where we got people to talk about climate change on our island in Second Life, and it was sort of deliberately coincided. It was partly because we knew we'd get a bit of publicity that way, but also it was sort of making a not so subtle point about the irony of all these thousands of people getting on planes and traveling to Bali to talk about the problem of climate change and trying to say that there's perhaps another way of being able to meet. And of course, this is also a way for people to meet. In sort of virtually face to face, without having to get on a plane. So it's also a big save. It saves time. You can, have a meeting that's an hour or two long, with lots of people from around the world all meeting, as it were, virtually face to face, and it sort of makes sense. Whereas it just wouldn't make sense for us to have this meeting an hour or two long because of the time some of us spend getting here. Nature Proceedings. And we're hearing from Paul later, but is sort of our attempt to do, to try and instigate or try and provoke some of the biomedical researchers to do what most of the physicists are already doing at the archive, which is to share early findings in the form of preprints. We don't only accept preprints, we'll accept conference presentations and posters and things like that as well, but the majority of them are preprints. It's still a very minority activity among biomedical researchers. Most of them don't like sharing this stuff. We've sort of hooked this up with the manuscript submission system for our journal, so that when you go and submit something to an MPG journal, it will give you the option of, do you also want to post it immediately to proceedings and kind of reveal it to the world? Of course, most people decline that offer, but enough of them do to, it's somewhere in the higher hundreds rather than thousands or tens of thousands of documents at the moment. It's been going about a year now. So we're reasonably pleased with progress. I'm really pleased with the functionality of the site. I think it's actually a lot better than when we launched it. It's got some nice functionality. But it's still a minority activity. It still takes a lot of effort to encourage people to post stuff. Some people, when we launched this, were very cynical about our motives for doing it. Some people even said we created it deliberately to fail, so this kind of thing can't work. But those people haven't actually submitted anything, right? I mean, the way to call our bluff would be to submit some stuff, right? And then try and help make it work. And Hilary Spencer runs this. She's in my team. She works out of New York. And, she tirelessly goes all over the place talking about it, encouraging people to submit. And she would not forgive me if I didn't encourage you to do the same. So please submit your papers and presentations and so forth to Nature Proceedings if they're sort of inappropriate subject areas. Absolutely. I'd be happy. I mean, this presentation is public as far as I'm concerned, so anyone can have a copy, and I will stick it on proceedings as well. Scintilla is an information aggregation and personalization tool. Famously, scientists are struggling with the information deluge. This is a sort of a step in trying to help deal with that. It aggregates information from many hundreds, possibly thousands of sources. I can't tell you the exact list. And when you go in there, you can either just use it anonymously and it will tell you kind of what's being reported on the blogs or what's being, what's the latest in the job feeds and, so on and so forth. Or you can go in there, much better to go in there, create an account and personalize it. Tell it what you're interested in, which sources you're interested in, which, PubMed search terms you're interested in. And then as you use it, you can also rate things, recommend things to other users, create groups and share things with one another. And as you do that, it learns more and more about your preferences and can be more proactive in recommending stuff to you. This is one of our youngest projects, so it's still under development. It's still getting up to speed, but it's a great piece of functionality. And actually, it's not only a user-facing service. We use some of the functionality kind of under the hood to drive some of our other features on nature.com. So it's a really important piece of infrastructure for us as well. We just recently launched a wiki to go along with a paper in Nature Reviews Genetics, authored by Lincoln Stein. Lincoln is a very well-known genomics researcher. He's also very well-known in web circles because he's a very well-known web programmer. He wrote something called CGIPM that one who's involved in web script development will have heard of. And he wrote this review about resources in biology and the cyber infrastructure, and it included some information about what resources are out there and what they do. And it seemed to us that should be a living document. It shouldn't just be static. So although the review itself is a static document, we did have some discussion about whether that should be wikified. I just think that would have been misguided. This is, you know, it's Lincoln's article. He wrote it. It's very good. I don't think people would have a strong incentive to go and mess with it. But the information that's attached to that about what resources are out there absolutely needs updating and possibly is not even complete, you know, at time of publication, but will certainly go out of date. And so we're encouraging people to go in and help keep that up to date. We've also got a whole bunch of databases and gateways that we're working on. And I'm not going to list them all because there's sort of six or seven or eight of those projects that we're working on, run by a guy called Matt Day in our London office. I think the important thing here is that particularly in biology, and actually all our current projects in this area are in biology, mostly in molecular biology and cellular biology. Particularly in biology over the last few years, databases have just increased in importance. And for many researchers, they're a more important and relevant source of information now than the journals. They're complementary to the journals, I think, fundamentally. But if you just think about how much individual researchers depend on journals versus databases, there are certainly some that depend much more on databases. And I think, you know, going back to what I said about us being a scientific communication company, not a journal publisher per se, I think it would be wrong, even dangerous for us to ignore that space. I think most journal publishers have ignored it. There are some exceptions, but most of them have. They're not very involved with scientific databases. We've been doing this stuff now for a few years. I'm trying to think how many years, 6 or 7 years now, that we started our original one, the Signaling Gateway, and it's since expanded to a whole series of other ones. They're all free at the point of use. They're funded. Mainly, we're contracted by our partners. We work with partners on these, I should mention. They're mostly NIH-funded groups. There are some exceptions, but they're mostly NIH-funded groups, like the Cell Migration Consortium, the Consortium for Functional Glycomics. There's a whole bunch of others. The NCI, National Cancer Institute, we work with. An important project with them. And they basically contract us to do this work. And so the end results are free at the point, you know, free for everyone to use. But we're basically being paid to do what in many ways are traditional editorial and publishing tasks, but it's in a completely new context, in the context of databases. So we're writing content, we're writing kind of news and summaries and highlights, we're selecting papers to highlight to people. We're also, that usually forms a kind of an editorial, as it were, front end to the database, but we're also engaged in the databases themselves. So for example, with the NCI, they've commissioned us basically to curate a database for them. So we're doing database curation, which is conceptually similar to the kind of work we do with journals, but actually in detail is very different. So we're learning new skills whilst at the same time applying our traditional strengths. The Signaling Gateway that I mentioned, the very first one that we launched, has a database called the Molecule Pages, which is information about proteins involved in cellular signaling. And that information is peer-reviewed, right? So it's expert-authored and peer-reviewed. So it's really like a review journal. We will approach experts and ask them to write a molecule page on a particular protein. So we commission that work, we select the experts. We then take what they've done and we send it out for review, just as we would on a review journal, for peer review. But it's a database, it's highly structured information, and the process of authoring a molecule page is very different from the process of authoring a review journal. There's lots of forms and all of that kind of stuff. So it's the same, and we're trying to apply our traditional strengths and skills, but the detail of how it's implemented is very different. And so we've learned a lot in that process. And then, you know, I have to mention Science Food Camp. We do Science Food Camp as well. This is an event that we run each year at Google in California, and we organize it with Google and with O'Reilly Media. So Tim O'Reilly was the initiator of the Foo Camp format, which is basically where you get a bunch of interesting people together for a weekend to hang out and talk about whatever they want to talk about. And he pioneered that format in the technology space. And so Science Foo Camp, even though it's a real world event and, you know, formally doesn't really have anything to do with the web or information technology, you know, has really been inspired by what's been going on in the technology space, particularly by the Foo Camp format that Jim O'Reilly and his colleagues developed. And of course, it's hosted at the Googleplex, so you know that's also a very strong sort of technological link. And we try and get scientists, not only scientists from all disciplines together, but we try and get technologists in there, investors, writers, you know, other thinkers who we think are going to be interesting to the mix. And I think the important bit there is that's a combination actually of both parts of our mission statement. Like, this is helping to disseminate the fruits of science to society at large in the form of these writers, you know, business people, technologists, and so forth. But also importantly, this is an interdisciplinary scientific meeting. Right? I mean, even the biggest scientific meetings these days, perhaps especially the biggest scientific meetings, are really focused on one particular area. Right? I'm a neuroscientist. The annual Society for Neuroscience meeting is 20 or 30,000 people, but they're all neuroscientists. Right? So going back to, you know, why nature exists and what we're trying to do, one of the things we're trying to do is break down boundaries between disciplines. Right? That's a really hard thing to do. But this is another way in which we try and fulfill that mission and try and encourage interdisciplinary interaction. And in fact, Science Foo Camp does give rise to many collaborations, some of which we hear about. So these are projects that have come out of the department that I run, web publishing. There's other stuff going on in other parts of Nature, though. For example, Nature Education, which was formed about a year ago, hasn't yet launched anything, but we'll be doing so soon. They've got some really interesting things and thoughts and ideas about the way that science should be communicated in this new networked world. So watch this space on that front. And other parts of the company are doing interesting things too, but these are the projects that I'm closest to, so that's why I mentioned them. I think, you know, these projects, I think, are sort of representative of a really big transition that's going on in scientific publishing. I think there are two important parts to it, and I think only half of it is widely recognised. There's already been a transition from print to online, and that's widely recognised. And with that has come transition in our mindset from print first, with online as an afterthought, to now online is primary. Online is, you know, the definitive version of the paper. It's the thing that that all our systems are oriented towards producing. And if anything, it's print that's the kind of the offshoot. And I think we will see, going forward, we'll see many print journals becoming online-only journals. I think journals like Nature itself will be the last to go that route because they're sort of magazines as well. They've got a front part of magazine-like material as well. But I think we'll see a lot of that happening. We already know that for many journals, probably for most journals, the access is almost all online. That doesn't mean they're consumed online. Often that people will download the PDF and print it off, consume as a print item, but the delivery is all electronic. It's not in print anymore. But I think that's only the half of the transition. If you think about some of the things I've been talking about here, this is not any longer just about delivering content. It's about providing functionality. And I haven't really talked about it, but it also means functionality in the context of delivering content. When we deliver an article to you, we ought to be able to provide links and other types of functionality around that. Interactive data sets, interactive figures, you know, queryable data sets, that kind of stuff, that can enhance the experience and enhance the understanding of the written material. But a lot of this stuff, you know, when you think about Connoisseur or Scintilla, those kinds of things, that's sort of pure functionality. We're not generating content there. That's pure functionality. And so one of the things that's happening is that publishers are going, you know, not only gone from print to online, they're going from online content delivery to online, you know, functionality provision, right? So we're more and more turning into something closer to a software company, right? Which is exciting and scary, you know, and the proportions of those depend on your particular perspective. I think the other important thing to say about this is our attitude in launching all of these, right? We don't, I think, you know, we're not presumptuous at all in doing these things. It's not an issue of, you know, if we build it, they will come. It's much more an issue of, you know, unless we build it, we won't know. These are experiments, okay? We we don't know if these are what people want to use, but there's no way of finding out. You know, I went going back to the podcast example earlier, you know, the product is the market research, okay? And so one of the upshots of that is, so, you know, one of the upshots of that is that it's okay to fail. We don't try to fail. We try very hard not to fail. But actually, if we don't ever fail, we're not trying hard enough. So it takes me a little bit back to my lab days. You know, I just hope I don't fail as often with these things as I did when I was in the lab with my experiments, because then I might be in trouble. But I think, you know, we need to adopt, as it were, a scientific mindset. You know, I consider myself to be, if you like, an experimental publisher, right? As opposed to a theoretical publisher or whatever other publishers there are. But we need to, I think, adopt this mindset of it's okay to experiment and it's okay to fail. And, you know, we obviously hope that people like you won't hold that against us if we do. And our experience to date has been that you don't. I think the other important thing about how we approach the opportunities and threats online is sort of being clear about what we should and shouldn't be worried about. I think one of the things that some people in publishing are worried about, and some scientists sometimes tell us we should be worried about, is scientists themselves, you know, doing the publishing. Okay, so I mean, a good example of that might be Open Wetware. I could pick any number of other examples, but Open Wetware project out of MIT, you know, it's a wiki, based on Media Wiki, and it's a platform for scientists to share protocols and other kinds of information. It's a great project, and I know that team quite well, and I really admire what they've done. But I think what happens in those situations, and I could talk about a lot of other projects that we've been involved in or that we know about, is what Tim O'Reilly actually identified when we were helping him with his first bioinformatics conference, which is about 2002. We had a session about, you know, how publishers maintain their relevance or something like that. And there was some fairly vociferous kind of opposition from people who are saying that publishers are irrelevant now. We've got the web. We don't need publishers in order to disseminate this information. The means of distribution are now in the hands of everyone. And that's obviously true. But I think Tim made an important point there, which is as soon as you start doing this stuff for yourself, right, you actually become a publisher. There still is work involved in doing it, right? And in fact, that's how Tim got into publishing, right? He wanted to do certain types of books. And he tried to get it done through other publishers, and they couldn't do it, so he ended up doing it himself, and he ended up becoming a publisher. And in fact, in the case of Open Wetware, they've recently recruited Laurie Lejeune, who used to work at O'Reilly, as their publisher, and they now have somebody running it, right? So I think it's a mistake to say that you can just do it yourself and still be a scientist and, you know, concentrate on your science, because this stuff does involve work. It doesn't mean that the current incumbent publishers should necessarily be the ones doing it, right? I mean, and we have to learn new skills in order to be able to do this type of stuff. So it is a competitive threat in that sense, but I don't think it's a sort of existential threat in the sense of making us, you know, immediately irrelevant. I think there are some bigger threats actually out there, and one of them is around peer review, right? So this is a potential threat rather than an actual threat at this point. But I really enjoyed this paper that's on the archive by Rodriguez and Bolland. Which proposes an automatic algorithm for assigning peer reviewers. So it basically proposes, they didn't develop it, but they're proposing an automated peer review system for the archival systems like it. And I think one of the interesting things for me about the whole debate around open access was that there was always the kind of assumption, spoken or otherwise, about the fact that peer review needed to be done, it needs to be done in the way that's currently done, and somebody needs to do that, and therefore it needs to be the publishers, and they need to be compensated for that. And I think as things currently stand, that's true. But I think, you know, where open access and author pays publishing is really ultimately a debate about, you know, who pays. But it's not, there's no question that somebody ought to pay something. There's a potentially a much greater threat if new, better, more efficient models of peer review arise. And one of the reasons why a couple of years ago we did an open peer review experiment on Nature, which we stopped after 4 months or so, it was a trial which we decided not to continue, but it's because we think it's really important if there are better ways of doing peer review that are enabled by the web now that we've got other, you know, potentials, different ways of doing things, that you know, we want to be the first to find it. We want to be, you know, blazing a trail there. We don't want somebody else to steal a march on us, because peer review is really central to what we do with journals, and I think we shouldn't take it for granted. That said, there aren't better models out there yet that I'm aware of, but I think we should keep looking. I think it's one of the challenges that we face. I'm just looking at the time. I'll skip one or two slides here. I'll skip this one, but I'll go back to this maybe. In fact, I'll skip that. But let me just wrap up with the final slide. I think the point I was going to make with this actually was that I think I think one of the interesting things is that as these technological changes happen, we kind of end up, I think, being forced to reassess our own assumptions about what we're doing and why we're doing it. Okay, so I think, for example, in the case of trade publishing, what's called trade publishing, these are the people that bring you books by Jeffrey Archer and Dan Brown and people like that, and you thought science publishers had a lot to answer for. But trade publishers have been really, you know, forced by, I think, these kinds of developments. In other words, people reading their phones to reassess what is it that we do. You know, do we sell books or do we sell entertainment, enlightenment, engagement, and that kind of thing? And I think one of the trends that you see in Japan is the rise of what they call the Keitai novel. Keitai is the Japanese word for mobile phone. And these are novels that are designed not only to be consumed on mobile phones, so sorry for the Japanese text, but even if you can't understand Japanese, I think you can see it's actually quite spare text. There's relatively short lines, just a piece of dialogue. It's designed to be read on a mobile phone, but actually most of them are written on mobile phones, right? I mean, so people actually type out novels with their thumbs. Last year, 5 of the top 10 best-selling novels in Japan were Keitai novels, okay? So this is just like a really profound shift in what publishers, in this case trade publishers, are delivering and how that content is created and consumed. And I think they're being forced to revisit the assumption that a novel needs to be 100,000 words and it needs to be 250 pages and it needs to be bound up in a book. And we sort of knew that anyway. You know, there's been great stories written in a lot less than 100,000 words, right? There's great poetry, and maybe we'll see the rise of, you know, a resurgence in interest in poetry because of the nature of the medium now. I think technology doesn't change to assist us or to reflect our needs and wants. Our behavior also changes in response to technology, hence the kind of texting type language that we saw earlier. You know, and famously, you know, Hemingway wrote for a bar bet, a story in 6 words, right, full of pathos and you know, a moving story in 6 words, right? I mean, so people have done it, but I think it hasn't been sort of mainstream in that sense. And I think the technology is forcing us to revisit what we do and why we do it. And I think the same goes for scientists. You know, I think when you look at all the opportunities there are for scientists to share information with one another, I think you discover that actually scientists don't publish in journals to share information with one another. They publish in journals because it helps them get their grants and get tenure. Because if they were doing it to share information with one another, they'd all be blogging and they'd be posting their papers online and they'd be putting in proceedings and all of this kind of stuff, right? Which by and large, they're not. And I think also we were talking earlier on yesterday about the story that was reported in among other places in Nature last week about the physicists who had the people in the audience take photographs of their slides and then run off and publish stuff off the back of it. You know, which I think you can argue about the rights and wrongs of that, but I think it's sort of indicative of the fact that when we present things at conferences, we don't necessarily present it in order to share that data with everyone. We present it in order to get some kudos and recognition for what we've done, but not really to give them the data just yet, right? And I think it sort of forces us to reassess what we're doing. And I think from publishers, from our perspective, and going back to the sort of analogy with travel and migrants, you know, whether we like it or not, we sort of find ourselves on this journey, this one-way ticket to the future. And I think it would do us a lot of good, if I speak as a publisher, I think it would do us a lot of good to adopt the kind of mindset that I think you see with migrants, with successful migrant communities that, you know, are around, you know, learning the new languages, respecting cultural norms, right? For example, it's not, if you talk about music, right, it's not, don't pick fights with your customers, right? I mean, it's not up to music lovers to find a way of enjoying music that allows record companies to make a profit, it's kind of the other way around, right? The record company has to find a way to make money that allows people to enjoy the music in the way they want to. So the onus is on us, for sure. You know, don't have a sense of entitlement just because we're incumbent. And that's actually a well-established business, you know, practice. You know, only the paranoid survive kind of thing. Like, we shouldn't feel that we've automatically got an entitlement to this. And I think some publishers, particularly the non-profit publishers, sometimes feel that way, or at least behave like they feel that way. And, you know, we need to work hard. We need to listen, learn, and adapt. And I think that's a relatively sort of humble posture, but I think that humility will be our strength, just as it is for migrants when they move to new countries. You know, publishing is being disrupted, but that means it's exciting too, you know, and to use an analogy, I don't mean this literally, of course, we're not in Kansas anymore, but that's good because it was a pretty boring place before. So thank you very much for your attention.
Since it's cutting into my time, I'm happy to let you all have as many questions.
Thanks, Paul. not everyone else won't necessarily have to. Michael.
You talked about nature proceedings and a sort of slow takeoff. I'm just wondering, and maybe Paul can comment on it. I mean, these things often take several years to become established. Do you know how it compares to, for example, the takeoff in traffic of the archive in the early days?
You know, I haven't personally looked at the comparison with the archive, although my understanding, and Paul or others can correct me if I'm not wrong, is that, I don't know the answer, but I think in some senses they may not be comparable anyway, because, you know, there was already a pre-print culture in physics before the archive, right? So I don't know, if we're doing it as well as the archive was doing back then I'd be quite pleased, but in that sense, although of course the web is much more pervasive now than it was then, so I don't know the answer. We've compared it with other things that have been launched in a similar space, some of which are around and some of which are not, most of which are not, and we're generally doing a lot better than those things did. So we're doing better this time. It's later, you know, I mean, you know, maybe the timing's better, maybe we've done some things right, I don't know, but we're doing a bit better than other people have done in the same space, but that's not saying a lot because most of those closed down. So, you know, we'll see. We're doing well enough to keep it going from our perspective, but whether it will really go critical or not, it remains to be seen.
It's a follow-on question in some sense. I presume nature is losing money.
Not on all of it, no. Big picture is that the database stuff is a reasonable business. The audio and video stuff is around break-even or thereabouts, but we're still investing quite a lot in video right now. So the what I would call community software or social software side of things, you know, everything Commentier, Nature Network, HP Seedings, that kind of stuff, by and large, those don't generate any revenue. I mean, we're not focused on making money out of them. There are some exceptions. Nature Network has some sponsorship. I'm trying to think of another exception. There may not be one, but we're focused on making them useful, getting, you know, encouraging people to use them, and we have some ideas for how we can make money out of them, but that's not a priority right now. I mean, there's no point in trying to make money out of something that people aren't using, right? Because you're going to fail, and we might lose focus on the, you know, that initial challenge. So we're trying to stay focused on that by and large. Yeah.
Can you just give a sense of how your part of the company fits in with the rest of the company? Are you separate? And what's your sort of relative size? Are you growing?
So most of the projects I talked about came out of a department called Web Publishing that was founded about 2.5 years ago, and that started off with half a dozen of us. It probably has about 35 people now, off the top of my head. We're trying to keep it about that size because otherwise it just I just won't be able to manage it. But obviously I can't already. But that's about the right size, I think. The way it works with the rest of the company, until about a year and a half ago, it was relatively separate from the rest of the company. We tried, and each project was relatively independent from the others as well. We were trying to sort of sow lots of seeds and see which ones worked out. We're doing more and more now to integrate it with the rest of the company. So just over a year ago, I took on responsibility for nature.com, which is the main platform. And so that was also a sort of recognition that we wanted some of this other stuff to kind of infect, as it were, in a good way, nature.com, right? We want some of that Web 2.0 type thinking, for want of a better term, to inform what we're doing on nature.com. It's not just a journal delivery platform. And we thought we had enough experience under our belt to sort of make that happen. So, and at the same time, the projects themselves are coming closer together. We want the applications to be able to talk with one another and share information to be able to serve users better. We want to be able to rationalize some of the technology a bit to make things a bit more bearable. So we're now in the process of putting it together.
And the whole company?
The whole company, the Nature Publishing Group is about 750 people. Yeah, and we're part of Macmillan Publishers, which is about 10 times that size, roughly speaking. Yeah.
So I want to follow up to a certain extent on the previous question. You mentioned, I guess it's already in effect that you moved over to thinkingnature.com as the main thing and the print to derive. So what about advertising?
Great question. Advertisers are still fairly print-centric. Our advertising salespeople are still fairly print-centric. Although I would distinguish between display advertising, so the kinds of the ads, the banner ads you see online, or the kind of glossy ads that you see in print about advertising certain products, and classified advertising. Our classified advertising business, which actually I've been running for the last year or so, is much more online-centric. About two years ago, we switched Nature Jobs, which is our jobs classifying business, we switched it around from being, we'll send you a print ad, and if you give us a bit of extra money, we'll put it online too, to you get the online listing for free, and then we'll try and upsell you. And the ultimate upsell is a print ad. We turned that on its head because the dynamics of competing in the online space is just so different from competing in print, and it's working really well for us at the moment. So classified has sort of already got there, although even there, most of the revenue still comes from print. But we think we're well positioned online. Display advertising, it's a bit different. I mean, things are lagging further behind. I think it's partly our fault, but I think it's also in large part the advertiser. There's a lot of inertia in the system. The advertisers still want to advertise in print, and you know, the readers are online by and large. And also because our offerings online aren't as good as they should be. I mean, I don't think we're doing as good a job. Collectively, actually, not just Nature Publishing, but collectively, I think publishers aren't doing as good a job as we can to be imaginative in the way we deliver advertising online. Advertising, you know, seen as a distraction, it should be useful information to get it right. I mean, for the recipient, you know, not just for the advertiser. So, the revenues are still modest online compared to print, but they're growing much more rapidly. Our biggest advertising journals, Nature, Nature Biotechnology, Nature Reviews, Drug Discovery, will continue to exist in print for some time to come. I think there's still quite a lot of demand for those as print collections.